Chapter 41. Ought to have had nearly $14,000 left. It was time, I thought, to indemnify myself for my years of suffering, and surround my child and myself with such moderate comforts as our means allowed. I went to my daughter and explained to her that I desired to make an encroachment upon our little hoard. To my utter amazement, she burst into tears, and told me that as he had not got a dollar, that all of our wealth had been stolen from her. Almost overwhelmed by this new misfortune, I in vain endeavored to discover from her in what manner our savings had been plundered. She could afford me no explanation beyond what I might gather from an abundance of sobs, and a copious flow of tears. It was a bitter blow, doctor, but nil desperandum was my motto, so I went to work at my crucible again, with redoubled energy, and made an ingot nearly every second day. I determined this time to put them in some secure place myself, but the very first day I set my apparatus in order for the projection, the girl Marion, that is my daughter's name, came weeping to me, and implored me to allow her to take care of our treasure. I refused decisively, saying that, having found her already incapable of filling the trust, I could place no faith in her again. But she persisted, clung to my neck, threatened to abandon me, in short, used so many of the bad, but irresistible arguments known to women, that I had not the heart to refuse her. As he has since that time continued to take the ingots. Yet you behold, continued the old alchemist, casting an inexpressibly mournful glance around the wretched apartment, the way we live. Our food is insufficient, and of bad quality. We never buy clothes. The rent of this hole is a mere nothing. What am I to think of the wretched girl who plunges me into this misery? Is she a miser, think you, or a female gamester? Or does she squander it riotously in places I know not of? Oh, doctor, doctor, do not blame me if I heap imprecations on her head, for I have suffered bitterly. The poor man here closed his eyes and sank back groaning on his bed. This singular narrative excited in me the strangest emotions. I glanced at the girl Marion, who had been a patient listener to these horrible accusations of cupidity, and never did I behold a more angelic air of resignation than beamed over her countenance. It was impossible that anyone with those pure, limpid eyes, that calm, broad forehead, that childlike mouth, could be such a monster of avarice or deceit as the old man represented. The truth was plain enough. The alchemist was mad. What alchemist was there ever who was not? And his insanity had taken this terrible shape. I felt an inexpressible pity move my heart for this poor girl, whose youth was burdened with such an awful sorrow. What is your name? I asked the old man, taking his tremulous, fevered hand in mine. William Blakelock, he answered. Come of an old Saxon stock, sir, that bred true men and women in former days. God! How did it ever come to pass that such a one as that girl ever sprung from our line? The glance of loathing and contempt that he cast at her made me shudder. May you not be mistaken in your daughter? I said, very mildly. Delusions with regard to alchemy are, or have been, very common. What, sir? Cried the old man, bounding in his bed. Hat? Do you doubt that gold can be made? Do you know, sir, that M. C. Theodore Tiffereau made gold at Paris in the year 1854 in the presence of M. Level, the assayer of the Imperial Mint, and the result of the experiments was read before the Academy of Sciences on the 16th of October of the same year? But stay, you shall have better proof yet. I will pay you with one of my ingots, and you shall attend me until I am well. Get me an ingot. This last calm, and was addressed to Marion, who was still kneeling close to her father's bedside. I observed her with some curiosity as this mandate was issued. She became very pale, clasped her hands convulsively, but neither moved, nor made any reply. Get me an ingot, I say, reiterated the alchemist passionately. She fixed her large eyes imploringly upon him. Her lips quivered, and two huge tears rolled slowly down her white cheeks. Obey me, wretched girl, cried the old man in an agitated voice, or I swear, by all that I reverence in heaven and earth, that I will lay my curse upon you forever. I felt for an instant that I ought perhaps to interfere and spare the girl the anguish that she was so evidently suffering, but a powerful curiosity to see how this strange scene would terminate withheld me. The last threat of her father, uttered as it was with a terrible vehemence, seemed to appall Marion. She rose with a sudden leap, as if a serpent had stung her, and, rushing into an inner apartment, returned with a small object which she placed in my hand, and then flung herself in a chair in a distant corner of the room, weeping bitterly. You see," said the old man sarcastically, "how reluctantly she parts with it. Take it, sir, it is yours." It was a small bar of metal. I examined it carefully, poised it in my hand. The color, weight, everything, announced that it really was gold. "You doubt its genuineness, perhaps," continued the alchemist. "There are acids on yonder table, test it." I confess that I did doubt its genuineness. But after I had acted upon the old man's suggestion, all further suspicion was rendered impossible. It was gold of the highest purity. I was astounded. Was then, after all, this man's tale a truth? Was his daughter, that fair, angelic-looking creature, a demon of avarice, or a slave to worse passions? I felt bewildered. I had never met with anything so incomprehensible. I looked from father to daughter in the blankest amazement. I suppose that my countenance betrayed my astonishment, for the old man said, "I perceive that you are surprised. Well, that is natural. You had a right to think me mad until I proved myself sane. But, Mr. Blakelock," I said, "I really cannot take this gold. I have no right to it. I cannot in justice charge so large a fee." Take it," he answered impatiently. "Your fee will amount to that before I am well. Besides," he added mysteriously, "I wish to secure your friendship. I wish that you should protect me from her," and he pointed his poor, bandaged hand at Marion. My eyes followed his gesture, and I caught the glance that replied, a glance of horror, distrust, despair. The beautiful face was distorted into positive ugliness. "It's all true," I thought. "She is the demon that her father represents her." I now rose to go. This domestic tragedy sickened me. This treachery of blood against blood was too horrible to witness. I wrote a prescription for the old man, left directions as to the renewal of the dressings upon his burns, and, bidding him good night, hastened toward the door. While I was fumbling on the dark, crazy landing for the staircase, I felt a hand laid on my arm. "Doctor," whispered a voice that I recognized as Marion Blakelock's. "Doctor, have you any compassion in your heart?" "I hope so," I answered shortly, shaking off her hand. Her touch filled me with loathing. "Hush! Don't talk so loud. If you have any pity in your nature, give me back, I entreat of you, that gold ingot which my father gave you this evening." "Great heaven," said I, "can it be possible that so fair a woman can be such a mercenary, shameless wretch?" "Ah, you know not, I cannot tell you. Do not judge me harshly. I call God to witness that I am not what you deem me. Some day or other you will know." "But," she added, interrupting herself, "the ingot, where is it? I must have it. My life depends on your giving it to me." "Take it, impostor," I cried, placing it in her hand, that closed on it with a horrible eagerness. "Never intended to keep it. Gold made under the same roof that covers such as you must be accursed." So saying, heedless of the nervous effort she made to detain me, I stumbled down the stairs and walked hastily home. The next morning, while I was in my office, smoking my matutinal cigar, and speculating over the singular character of my acquaintances of last night, the door opened, and Marion Blakelock entered. She had the same look of terror that I had observed the evening before, and she panted, as if she had been running fast. father has got out of bed, she gasped out, and insists on going on with his alchemy. Will it kill him? Not exactly, I answered coldly. It were better that he kept quiet, so as to avoid the chance of inflammation. However, you need not be alarmed. His burns are not at all dangerous, although painful. Thank God! Thank God! She cried, in the most impassioned accents. And, before I was aware of what she was doing, she seized my hand and kissed it. There, that will do, I said, withdrawing my hand. You are under no obligations to me. You had better go back to your father. I can't go, she answered. You despise me, is it not so? I made no reply. You think me a monster, a criminal. When you went home last night, you were wonderstruck that so vile a creature as I should have so fair a face. You embarrass me, madam, I said, in a most chilling tone. Pray relieve me from this unpleasant position. Wait. I cannot bear that you should think ill of me. You are good and kind, and I desire to possess your esteem. You little know how I love my father. I could not restrain a bitter smile. You do not believe that? Well, I will convince you. I have had a hard struggle all last night with myself, but am now resolved. This life of deceit must continue no longer. Will you hear my vindication? I assented. The wonderful melody of her voice, and the purity of her features were charming me once more. I half believed in her innocence already. My father has told you a portion of his history. But he did not tell you that his continued failures in his search after the secret of metallic transmutation nearly killed him. 2 years ago he was on the verge of the grave, working every day at his mad pursuit, and every day growing weaker and more emaciated. I saw that, if his mind was not relieved in some way, he would die. The thought was madness to me, for I loved him, I love him still, as a daughter never loved a father before. During all these years of poverty I had supported the house with my needle. It was hard work, but I did it, I do it still. What? I cried, startled, does not, patience. Hear me out. My father was dying of disappointment. I must save him. By incredible exertions, working night and day, I saved about $35 in notes. These I exchanged for gold, and one day, when my father was not looking, I cast them into the crucible in which he was making one of his vain attempts at transmutation. God, I am sure, will pardon the deception. I never anticipated the misery it would lead to. I never beheld anything like the joy of my poor father, when, after emptying his crucible, he found a deposit of pure gold at the bottom. He wept, and danced, and sang, and built such castles in the air, that my brain was dizzy to hear him. He gave me the ingot to keep, and went to work at his alchemy with renewed vigor. The same thing occurred. He always found the same quantity of gold in his crucible. I alone knew the secret. He was happy, poor man, for nearly 2 years, in the belief that he was amassing a fortune. I all the while plied my needle for our daily bread. When he asked me for the savings, the first stroke fell upon me. Then it was that I recognized the folly of my conduct. I could give him no money. I never had any while he believed that I had $14,000. My heart was nearly broken when I found that he had conceived the most injurious suspicions against me. Yet I could not blame him. I could give no account of the treasure I had permitted him to believe was in my possession. I must suffer the penalty of my fault, for to undeceive him would be, I felt, to kill him. I remained silent then, and suffered. You know the rest. You now know why it was that I was reluctant to give you that ingot, why it was that I degraded myself so far as to ask it back. It was the only means I had of continuing a deception on which I believed my father's life depended. But that delusion has been dispelled. I can live this life of hypocrisy no longer. I cannot exist and hear my father, whom I love so, wither me daily with his curses. I will undeceive him this very day. Will you come with me, for I fear the effect on his enfeebled frame? Willingly, I answered, taking her by the hand, and I think that no absolute danger need be apprehended. Now, Marion, I added, let me ask forgiveness for having even for a moment wounded so noble a heart. You are truly as great a martyr as any of those whose sufferings the Church perpetuates in altar pieces. I knew you would do me justice when you knew all, she sobbed, pressing my hand. But come, I am on fire. Let us hasten to my father, and break this terror to him. When we reached the old alchemist's room, we found him busily engaged over a crucible which was placed on a small furnace, and in which some indescribable mixture was boiling. He looked up as we entered. No fear of me, doctor, he said, with a ghastly smile, no fear. I must not allow a little physical pain to interrupt my great work, you know. By the way, you are just in time. In a few moments the marriage of the Red King and White Queen will be accomplished, as George Ripley calls the great act, in his book entitled The Twelve Gates. Yes, doctor, in less than 10 minutes you will see me make pure, red, shining gold. And the poor old man smiled triumphantly, and stirred his foolish mixture with a long rod, which he held with difficulty in his bandaged hands. It was a grievous sight for a man of any feeling to witness. Father, said Marion, in a low, broken voice, advancing a little toward the poor old dupe, I want your forgiveness. Ah, hypocrite! For what? Are you going to give me back my gold? No, father, but for the deception that I have been practicing on you for 2 years, I knew it. I knew it, shouted the old man, with a radiant countenance. He has concealed my $14,000 all. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.